Chapter 42. In the papers at once, with my details, so as to try to raise the government's sympathy sufficiently to have better succor sent them than the cutter Colfax, which went a little way in search of them the other day, and then struck a fog, and gave it up. If the president were in Washington, I would telegraph him. When I hear that the Ona Smith has been found again, I mean to send for one of those darkies to come to Hartford and give me his adventures for an Atlantic article. Likely you will see my today's article in the newspapers. Here's ever, Mark. The revenue cutter Colfax went after the Jonas Smith, thinking there was mutiny or other crime on board. It occurs to me now that, since there is only mere suffering and misery, and nobody to punish, it ceases to be a matter which a republican form of government will feel authorized to interfere in further. Damn a republican form of government. Clemens thought he had given up lecturing for good. He was prosperous and he had no love for the platform. But one day an idea popped into his head. Thomas Nast, the Aether of the American cartoon, had delivered a successful series of illustrated lectures-talks for which he made the drawings as he went along. Mark Twain's idea was to make a combination with Nast. His letter gives us the plan in full. To Thomas Nast, Morristown, N.J. : Hartford, Con. 1877. My dear Nast, I did not think I should ever stand on a platform again until the time was come for me to say, die innocent. But the same old offers keep arriving. I have declined them all, just as usual, though sorely tempted, as usual. Now, I do not decline, because I mind talking to an audience, but because, one, traveling alone is so heartbreakingly dreary, and, two, shouldering the whole show is such a cheer-killing responsibility. Therefore, I now propose to you what you proposed to me in 1867, 10 years ago when I was unknown, viz. That you stand on the platform and make pictures, and I stand by you and blackguard the audience. I should enormously enjoy meandering around to big towns, don't want to go to the little ones, with you for company. My idea is not to fatten the lecture agents and lyceums on the spoils, but put all the ducats religiously into two equal piles, and say to the artist and lecturer, absorb these. For instance, here follows a plan, and a possible list of cities to be visited. The letter continues. Call the gross receipts $100, 000 for 4 months and a half, and the profit from $60, 000 to $75,000. I try to make the figures large enough, and leave it to the public to reduce them. I did not put in Philadelphia, because Pugh owns that town, and last winter when I made a little reading trip he only paid me $300, and pretended his concert I read 15 minutes in the midst of a concert, cost him a vast sum, and so he couldn't afford any more. I could get up a better concert with a barrel of cats. I have imagined two or three pictures, and concocted the accompanying remarks to see how the thing would go. I was charmed. Well, you think it over, Nast, and drop me a line. We should have some fun. Yours truly, Samuel 50. Clemens. The plan came to nothing. Nast, like Clemens, had no special taste for platforming, and while undoubtedly there would have been large profits in the combination, the promise of the venture did not compel his acceptance. In spite of his distaste for the platform, Mark Twain was always giving readings and lectures, without charge, for some worthy Hartford cause. He was ready to do what he could to help an entertainment along, if he could do it in his own way and original way, sometimes, and not always gratifying to the committee, whose plans were likely to be prearranged. For one thing, Clemens, supersensitive in the matter of putting himself forward in his own town, often objected to any special exploitation of his name. This always distressed the committee, who saw a large profit to their venture in the prestige of his fame. The following characteristic letter was written in self-defense when, on one such occasion, a committee had become sufficiently peevish to abandon a worthy enterprise. To an entertainment committee, in Hartford. November 9. E.S. Sykes, Esquire. Dr. Sir, Mr. Burton's note puts upon me all the blame of the destruction of an enterprise which had for its object the succor of the Hartford poor. That is to say, this enterprise has been dropped because of the dissatisfaction with Mr. Clemens' stipulations. Therefore I must be allowed to say a word in my defense. There were two stipulations, exactly two. I made one of them. If the other was made at all, it was a joint one, from the choir and me. My individual stipulation was that my name should be kept out of the newspapers. The joint one was that sufficient tickets to ensure a good sum should be sold before the date of the performance should be set. Understand, we wanted a good sum. I do not think any of us bothered about a good house. It was money we were after. Now you perceive that my concern is simply with my individual stipulation. Did that break up the enterprise? Eugene Burton said he would sell $300 worth of the tickets himself. Mr. Smith said he would sell $200, or $300 worth himself. My plan for Asylum Hill Church would have ensured $150 from that quarter. All this in the face of my stipulation. It was proposed to raise $1,000. Did my stipulation render the raising of $400, or $500 in a dozen churches impossible? My stipulation is easily defensible. When a mere reader or lecturer has appeared three or four times in a town of Hartford's size, he is a good deal more than likely to get a very unpleasant snub if he shoves himself forward about once or twice more. Therefore I long ago made up my mind that whenever I again appeared here, it should be only in a minor capacity and not as a chief attraction. Now, I placed that harmless and very justifiable stipulation before the committee the other day. They carried it to headquarters, and it was accepted there. I am not informed that any objection was made to it, or that it was regarded as an offense. It seems late in the day now, after a good deal of trouble has been taken, and a good deal of thankless work done by the committees, to suddenly tear up the contract, and then turn and bowl me down from long range as being the destroyer of it. If the enterprise has failed because of my individual stipulation, here you have my proper and reasonable reasons for making that stipulation. If it has failed because of the joint stipulation, put the blame there, and let us share it collectively. I think our plan was a good one. I do not doubt that Mr. Burton still approves of it too. I believe the objections come from other quarters, and not from him. Mr. Twitchell used the following words in last Sunday's sermon, if I remember correctly, : my hearers, the prophet Deuteronomy says this wise thing. Though ye plan a goodly house for the poor, and plan it with wisdom, and do take off your coats and set to build it, with high courage, yet shall the croaker presently come, and lift up his voice, having his coat on, and say, verily this plan is not well planned, and he will go his way, and the obstructionist will come, and lift up his voice, having his coat on, and say, behold, this is but a sick plan, and he will go his way. And the man that knows it all will come, and lift up his voice, having his coat on, and say, lo, call they this a plan? Then will he go his way, and the places which knew him once shall know him no more forever, because he was not, for God took him. Now therefore I say unto you, verily that house will not be budded. And I say this also, he that waiteth for all men, to be satisfied with his plan, let him seek eternal life, for he shall need it. Apostrophe, this portion of Mr. Twitchell's sermon made a great impression upon me, and I was grieved that someone had not wakened me earlier, so that I might have heard what went before. S. 50. Clemens. Mr. Sykes, of the firm of Sykes & Newton, the Allen House Pharmacy, replied that he had read the letter to the committee, and that it had said those gentlemen, right, who had not before understood the situation. If others were as ready to do their part as yourself, our poor would not want assistance, he said, in closing. We come now to an incident which assumes the proportions of an episode, even of a catastrophe, in Mark Twain's career. The disaster was due to a condition, noted a few pages earlier, the inability of genius to judge its own efforts. The story has now become history, printed history, it having been sympathetically told by Howells, in my Mark Twain, and more exhaustively, with a report of the speech that invited the lightning, in a former work by the present writer. The speech was made at John Greenleaf Whittier's 70th birthday dinner, given by the Atlantic staff on the evening of December 17, 1877. It was intended as a huge joke, a joke that would shake the sides of these venerable Boston deities, Longfellow, Emerson, Holmes, and the rest of that venerated group. Clemens had been a favorite at the Atlantic lunches and dinners, a speech by him always an event. This time he decided to outdo himself. He did that, but not in the way he had intended. To use one of his own metaphors, he stepped out to meet the rainbow, and got struck by lightning. His joke was not of the Boston kind or size. When its full nature burst upon the company, when the ears of the assembled diners heard the sacred names of Longfellow, Emerson, and Holmes lightly associated with human aspects removed, oh, very far removed, from Cambridge and Concord, a chill fell upon the diners that presently became amazement, and then creeping paralysis. Nobody knew afterward whether the great speech that he had so gaily planned ever came to a natural end or not. Somebody the next on the program attempted to follow him, but presently the company melted out of the doors and crept away into the night. It seemed to Mark Twain that his career had come to an end. Back in Hartford, sweating and suffering through sleepless nights, he wrote Howells his anguish. To W.D. Howells, in Boston. Sunday night, 1877. My dear Howells, my sense of disgrace does not abate. It grows. I see that it is going to add itself to my list of permanencies, a list of humiliations that extends back to when I was 7 years old, and which keep on persecuting me regardless of my repentances. I feel that my misfortune has injured me all over the country. Therefore it will be best that I retire from before the public at present. It will hurt the Atlantic for me to appear in its pages now. So it is my opinion and my wife's that the telephone story had better be suppressed. Will you return those proofs or revises to me, so that I can use the same on some future occasion? It seems as if I must have been insane when I wrote that speech and saw no harm in it, no disrespect toward those men whom I reverenced so much. And what shame I brought upon you, after what you said in introducing me. It burns me like fire to think of it. The whole matter is a dreadful subject, let me drop it here at least on paper. Penitently yours, Mark. Howells sent back a comforting letter. Have no idea of dropping you out of the Atlantic, he wrote, and Mr. Houghton has still less, if possible. You are going to help, and not hurt us many a year yet, if you will. You are not going to be floored by it. There is more justice than that, even in this world. Howells added that Charles Eliot Norton had expressed just the right feeling concerning the whole affair, and that many who had not heard the speech, but read the newspaper reports of it, had found it without offense. Clemens wrote contrite letters to Holmes, Emerson, and Longfellow, and received most gracious acknowledgments. Emerson, indeed, had not heard the speech. His faculties were already blurred by the mental mists that would eventually shut him in. Clemens wrote again to Howells, this time with less anguish. To W.D. Howells, in Boston. Hartford, Friday, 1877. My dear Howells, your letter was a godsend, and perhaps the welcomest part of it was your consent that I write to those gentlemen. Therefore you discouraged my hints in that direction, that morning in Boston, rightly too, for my offense was yet too new then. Warner has tried to hold up our hands like the good fellow he is, but poor Twitchell could not say a word, and confessed that he would rather take nearly any punishment than face Livy and me. He hasn't been here since. It is curious, but I pitched early upon Mr. Norton as the very man who would think some generous thing about that matter, whether he said it or not. It is splendid to be a man like that, but it is given to few to be. I wrote a letter yesterday, and sent a copy to each of the three. I wanted to send a copy to Mr. Whittier also, since the offense was done also against him, being committed in his presence and he the guest of the occasion, besides holding the well-nigh sacred place he does in his people's estimation. But I didn't know whether to venture or not, and so ended by doing nothing. It seemed an intrusion to approach him, and even Livy seemed to have her doubts as to the best and properest way to do in the case. I do not reverence Mr. Emerson less, but somehow I could approach him easier. Send me those proofs, if you have got them handy. I want to submit them to Willie. He won't show them to anybody. Had a very pleasant and considerate letter from Mr. Houghton today, and was very glad to receive it. You can't imagine how brilliant and beautiful that new brass fender is, and how perfectly naturally it takes its place under the carved oak. How they did scour it up before they sent it. I lied a good deal about it when I came home, so for once I kept a secret and surprised Livy on the Christmas morning. I haven't done a stroke of work since the Atlantic dinner, have only moped around. But I'm going to try tomorrow. How could I ever have? Ah, well, I am a great and sublime fool. But then I am God's fool, and all his works must be contemplated with respect. Gutenberg Edition. End of chapter.